It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you all for tuning in. So as Matthias said, I will be talking about explosion as physical bounds in star neutrinos. And before I get started, I just want to say that if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, things that you disagree with, or things that are not clear, please do interrupt me. I would love for this to be a discussion rather than just me yelling at my screen. So let me start with a short one-slide summary of the motivation behind this. So we know that there are still a number of outstanding problems in modern cosmology and particle physics. And those include dark matter, of course, neutrino masses, ground symmetry of the universe. And we also know that the standard model itself is not able to fully accommodate for these phenomena. And that's where star neutrinos come into play, because star neutrinos provide us a framework that can accommodate for all these observed phenomena. They can provide us a dark matter particle and heavier states that can take care of the neutrino masses and the baryon symmetry. So I will focus here on star neutrinos that connect to the standard model states through the neutrino portal. Can you see my cursor, by the way?
I don't think so.
I see it.
Oh, yeah, I see it now.
Ah, okay, yeah. Very good. So yeah, so I will consider the neutrino portal. So here, F is just the usual Yukawa matrix. L is the lepton doublet. H is the Higgs doublet. And then are the star neutrinos. And below electric symmetry breaking, L just becomes the left-handed neutrino field and H the vacuum expectation value. So this is nothing else than a Dirac mass term. Now, because star neutrinos are singlets with respect to the standard model gauge group, there's also nothing stopping us from adding a Majorana mass term for the star neutrinos. And as things usually go, if you want to consider the physical states, then you have to diagonalize the mass matrix. And this causes a mixing between the active and star neutrino states. And this mixing is characterized by a mass splitting and by a mixing angle, which I will denote as theta. And the mixing angle is just the Dirac mass divided by the Majorana mass. And eventually, this induces neutrino-like interactions for star neutrinos, but suppressed by this mixing angle. So a way to think about it is that the interaction rate star neutrinos with the standard model particles similarly to that of the active neutrinos, but suppressed by the mixing angle square. This approximation is not always true, but I think it gives some intuition. So once you introduce new particles to the system, you can of course search for them, you can constrain them and so on. And there are many different ways in which you can do that. Based on cosmological probes, astrophysical probes, and terrestrial experiments. I will focus on cosmological and astrophysical probes, in particular on BBN from the cosmology side and four galaxies from the astrophysics side. And towards the end, I will discuss very briefly something related to terrestrial experiments. So I'll start with the astrophysics. And this is based on a project that I did a year ago with all these people here. And the idea was to find state-of-the-art constraints on the mass of fermionic dark matter using phase-based consideration applied on dwarf spiral galaxies. So this is an idea that, a concept that was pioneered by Tremaine and Gunn back in the 1970s. And has been developed over the past decades. And here we try to take it to the next level. So just a short summary about dwarf galaxies. They are satellites of our Milky Way. And by now there have been a couple dozens of them observed. And they look like this. So I think the first thing you can notice here is that they contain a very little amount of stars. And you can imagine that because of this, it has taken quite some time to obtain reliable stellar photometric and kinematic data. But now, of course, we have that data. And what what is the most important thing here actually is that because there are so few stars here, because it contains so few stars, they are dark matter dominated. And this will be a very useful factor in what's coming next. So we have these dwarfs of the galaxies that are dark matter dominated. And from these dwarf galaxies, we can measure the dark matter density and velocity dispersion. And in the end, this will give us the so-called coarse grained phase space density, which is just density divided by velocity to the third. And it's called coarse grained because what we measure are actually average quantities, right? We measure average densities, average velocity dispersions. So the phase space density that we eventually compute itself is also an average quantity. On the other side, once you have your particle physics problem, particle physics model, you can directly compute, if it's not complicated, of course, the exact phase space density, and that's called the fine-grained phase space density. So we are interested in connecting the coarse grain and the fine-grained phase space densities. And I will show you two ways in doing that. One is based on Pauli's exclusion principle, which will give us a model independent bounds. The other one is based on Liouville's theorem, which is model dependent. So to compute the phase space density, we need the dark matter density profile and the velocity dispersion profile. Now, before you do any complicated computation or simulation, you can say, okay, I'll take a very simple approach. I just assume a certain profile, for example, the isothermal profile. With such a profile, the density decays as 1/r² at large radii, and towards the center tends to a constant. So such a profile, for example, can accommodate for the fact that the rotation curves of stars reaches a constant at large radii. And on top of that, you also can assume that the dark matter velocity dispersion is roughly the same as that of the stars. And you do the computation for a neutrino-like species and you find a bound of 0.1 keV. And this is an approach that the pioneering work of Tremaine and Gunn actually took. And it gives you, I think, a simple way to get an order of magnitude estimation. But suppose you want to take more of a data-driven approach, then you say, okay, to a good approximation, the stars in my galaxy, they obey the collisionist Boltzmann equation. And then you multiply the Boltzmann equation by velocity components and integrate. So you take the moments of the Boltzmann equation and you end up with this Jeans equation here. So nu here is the tracer density of the stars, or like in general of your particles. Sigma r is the radial velocity dispersion, beta is the velocity dispersion parameter, yes, the velocity, anisotropy parameter, sorry. And m of r is the mass contained within radius r. Because dwarf galaxies.
Hey, may I ask a question? Sorry for interrupting. So before you move on, so you say that Tremaine Gunn argument already gives you a good order of magnitude estimate. So why is it important to improve it? I mean, what do you gain? I mean,
oh, you get stronger constraints. I mean, that's the.
By how much?
I will show you.
Do you expect to get an order of magnitude different, or it's really we're really discussing like factors of order one here?
Let's see. We get about factor 6 improvements. Factor 6.
Okay, yeah. I see.
6-7.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thanks.
Yeah. So like the quantity we're interested in is this m of r. And it is therefore like because the dwarf galaxies are dark matter dominated, so to a good approximation is the mass of the dark matter contained in radius r. Now the problem with this equation is that none of these quantities, nu, sigma r, beta, m, are measured quantities. So you have here one equation with four unknowns. What we actually observe are line of sight velocities and projected tracer densities. Okay. Let's get rid of this. So the projected tracer density is sigma here, and it is related to nu to the tracer density by some integral. So once you know, like once you measure sigma, you can actually derive mu, but still, but this still leaves you with two equations and three unknowns. So this equation, for example, can provide you sigma of r as a function of beta and m, but then you still have a degeneracy between beta and m here. So I can choose whatever mass profile I want, and I can tune beta such that I satisfy both equations. Does this mean that this approach is worthless? No, because it turns out that the mass contained within the half-life radius of the dwarf galaxy is more or less independent of the exact profile of beta. And why this is the case? It's a very technical derivation, actually, which you can find in this paper. And this is actually what most people have been using so far. And this gives you the mass, an estimation of the mass at the half-life radius. You can then make the same assumption as before, saying that the dark matter velocity dispersion is the same as that of the stars. You redo your entire computation, and you get a factor of two improvement or so. So like your bound for a neutrino thermal lock speed becomes 0.2 keV or so. So, and this is where our work comes into play, because what we do is that we add these so-called various shape parameters. And they are actually like nothing but additional constraints on your parameters. And they are obtained from the fourth order Weyl theorem. And fourth order Weyl theorem, there are two of them, and each one of them gives you a constraint. And what I don't really get here is that the Weyl shape round is like these equations that have been derived from like 30 years ago. And it seems that only 5-6 years ago, people really started using them for some reason. I don't know why. So these constraints together with the Jeans equation and some additional components, they are implemented in the Grassery code, which is written by Justin Reeve, our collaborator on this project. And this code really solves the Jeans equation, taking all the constraints into account, and runs a big MCMC with the data, and you get this result. So here I show the density as a function of the radius. And these vertical lines here, those are like that, that's the half-life radius for each dwarf galaxy, okay? And you see that with this method, you can really probe the inner regions of each dwarf. And that's really where we win, because this at the smallest radii where the phase space density is the highest.
So just a question before you move on. What's the significance of that Weyl shape parameter?
The
second one that you said that it was derived some long time ago and people haven't used it. So I'm just trying to understand why it shows up now.
So I don't have a clear answer on why people haven't used it until recently. You just assume that you have a realized system, and in your realized system, you have this, like usually what people use is the second order Weyl theorem, but you can go to high orders, as shown in this paper by Merrifield and Kent, you get these two extra constraints. I don't know where the complication arises from for people not having considered it before. I don't know that. What I'll just know is that like Justin Reed has written a Grassery, like this Grassery code that contains these constraints with some extra stuff. But yeah. I don't know, really.
You were saying, though, so these extra Weyl shape parameters, these are derived not from the Jeans equations, but from the Weyl theorem? Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, so-called fourth order Weyl theorem. And there are like two of them. And like,
do you know what assumptions go into this derivation? Presumably, I guess you're assuming that it's equilibrium, I guess.
As usual, but you also assume that already from starting, but with the Jeans equation, that like you have a system that's non-rotating and so on. but I can say that it's not that like people have just used this and assumed it's correct. They have also done a high resolution simulations where they tracked these dwarf galaxies and then like obtained the profile and then saw how accurate this method is. And like like they match pretty well. And it's another paper by Justin Reeve actually, in which you can see this comparison. It's called to beta or not to beta, something like that. but like this method has been tested against simulations, is what I mean. Yeah. So, and then like, rather than assuming that the dark matter, that the dark matter has the same velocity dispersion as stars, what we can do is that we solve a second Jeans equation, this time for the dark matter itself. So the one here, like the first one we solved was for the stars, and this gave us M of R, which is the dark matter mass profile. And then we solve a second equation for the dark matter itself. Okay. So because we know M of R, we also know what a density profile looks like. So we want to solve for sigma of R, and the only thing we don't know is this beta, the anisotropic parameter. So what we do is that we impose a prior on beta, which looks like this gray region here. And this prior is motivated, or like it's like the boundaries, they are motivated by simulations. And we use two suites of simulations, the Aquarius and Edge, both within cold dark matter and warm dark matter cosmologies. And this is what we have used in the simulations. We've also tried to extend the prior by factor 5 or factor 10. And we found that this didn't really affect our results by much, only by a few tens of percent. So now that we have the dark matter density profile and the velocity dispersion, we can go ahead to compute the bounds. The first one is based on Pauli's principle. And what we really do here is that we just assume a self-gravitating object that fully consists of a degenerate Fermi gas. And such fermions, they have a certain velocity called the Fermi velocity, which is solely determined by the density and by the mass of the particles. And in order for such an object to exist, the Fermi velocity must be smaller than the escape velocity. And the escape velocity can be trivially computed now that we have the density profile. And if you plug in all the numbers, you get this result here. So the error bars, so this is not a measurement, but the error bars here just reflect the uncertainties in the determination of the density profile and the velocity dispersion. So if you want to use a true 2 sigma lower bound, then you should use 0.27 minus 0.14, which is 0.13 kV. And this is like model independent, it doesn't care about the production mechanism, doesn't care about the evolution of the distribution function, and it doesn't care about the baryonic physics. And then we have another approach based on Liouville's theorem, which is model dependent. So Liouville's theorem says that for a collisionless and dissipationless particle species, the fine-grained distribution function follows a Hamiltonian flow. So it means in particular that the maximum of the distribution function cannot increase. So it means that we have this, that the late time fine-grained phase-based density is smaller or equal to the primordial fine-grained phase-based density. And the primordial one is just given by mass to the power of 4 times the maximum of the distribution function, okay? And then since what we measure are actually average quantities, we have another equality here, which just says that the average of the quantity is always smaller or equal than its maximum. And the problem, well, it's not really a problem, but the downside of this approach is that it's model dependent because you need to know what fmax is, and fmax depends on your particle physics problem or your particle physics model. And but the upside of this is actually that you can apply to both fermions and bosons. So what's really left to do is to compute the coarse grained phase space density. And we have considered two ways in doing that. One is called maximal coarse grading, the other one Gaussian coarse grading. And with a maximal coarse grading, you just say that, hey, my dark matter must have a velocity smaller than the escape velocity. So for my velocity volume, I use a state velocity. And this gives you a conservative approach, like it's a conservative approach. And the like it can be used, for example, if you only have access to the density profile of your galaxy. On the other hand, since we have solved a second G equation for the dark matter and we know now the velocity dispersions, we can use the so-called Gaussian coarse graining. And what's here and what's left to do here is really that we need to assume a certain velocity dispersion. And in our case, a Gaussian distribution. And from that, we directly obtain its maximum, like this here. And like the Gaussian distribution is also moderated by simulation, by the way. So it's like an arbitrary choice. And they look like this. So you see that the Gaussian coarse graining, which is this blue dashed curve, is about a factor 40 larger than the solid curve, which is obtained with the maximal coarse graining approach. And since the bounds really go as some factor to the power 1/4, it means that we win 40 to the power 1/4, which is like a factor 2.5 in the mass bound by using the Gaussian coarse graining. And then we can apply all of this on star neutrinos. So here I show the branch space of resonantly produced star neutrinos. This is the mixing angle. This is its mass. And there's a third quantity, which is the lepton asymmetry, but it's tuned so to give you the correct relic density as a function of theta and m. So the blue hashed region is the result of this project. The gray region means that you overproduce the dark matter. Green is bounce from X-ray. The star with arrow bars is the star neutrino interpretation of the 3.5 keV line that has been observed a few years ago. And then the purple here is bound from BBN. And this is just obtained by saying that like, if you go to smaller and smaller mixing angles, you need a larger and larger lepton symmetry to still obtain the correct relic density. But at some point, your lepton symmetry is so large that it distorts the neutron proton conversion reactions and you get a helium abundance that is totally off. And then we have this red dash lines, which we have called Lyman alpha the favorite. And that's because in this particular result, they only considered a certain thermal history, but because we don't really know what its thermal history was at higher redshifts, people usually need to marginalize over the thermal histories.
Hello.
Hello.
So in this parameter space, as I understand you have some sort of, so what gives you the neutrino mass is something like a seesaw, right? Between the
yes.
So then
but this is for dark matter, by the way. This is not for the
okay, so something else is giving you the neutrino mass then.
You have heavier states that account for neutrino masses. Like this is way below the seesaw, like these particles don't contribute to the neutrino masses because they are so strongly constrained by X-ray. Like they live in this region here. And with such small mixing angles, the seesaw mechanism doesn't give.
Oh yeah, I wasn't sure because I mean, your mass is keV. So even the angle is small, the mass is also small. So I was gonna ask you where the seesaw band would be.
Yeah. Yeah, like the seesaw bond is actually way above, much harder than 10^-7. Yeah, okay. But these are excluded.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And this is flavor universal also.
No, like this particular one is star neutrino that mixes with muon neutrinos. Yeah.
Okay.
We have actually in the paper a paragraph on how the electron and tau neutrino bounds change.
But does it matter?
Oh, for the electron neutrino, I don't think so. So because like these particles are produced at the temperature of around 100 or 150 MeV. So you have enough muons and electrons there, I think the absence of charge currents in the case of tau mixing, because you don't have tau neutrinos at like the temperature 100 MeV or like a very little amount of them, it changes the picture a little bit, but I don't remember on top of my head which site. My guess is that it makes the bounds weaker, but I need to check. Like we have a paragraph if you're interested in this paper that you can.
May I ask, like, what are the assumptions that goes into the Lyman alpha?
So the Lyman alpha here is, so like the idea is that you look at the Lyman alpha power, like look at the Lyman alpha power spectrum, AC, a cutoff, small scales. Yeah. Now this cutoff can be due to the nature of dark matter. Like if you have a warm dark matter candidate, and like it suppresses matter perturbations at small scales. But also you have astrophysical effects, like pressure effects of your gas that could also prevent the clustering of matter at small scales. Yeah. And this particular bound is obtained by, I think, fixing like the thermal history. So I think they assume a certain parameterization and like fixed quantities of your astrophysics. And like the problem like here we have really with the Lyman alpha, we simply don't know what the astrophysics was like at high redshifts, at least as of yet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like you see, like it's quite a bit stronger. But the thing is that like I think the phase space bounds are a bit more robust, at least the assumptions are much, much different. So it's really like a complementary bounce to the Lyman alpha and to all the others too.
Yeah, thank you.
Can I ask something? One very quick question. So yes. I guess I'm not understanding what's different. So because there was already, I mean, these phase space bounds on stellar neutrinos, they are old, right? There's this paper by Boyarsky from very like 10, 15 years
from
old.
10 years ago, yeah.
Yeah.
He's actually an author on this work too.
Yeah, and they find the same bound. Essentially, I was just going over the paper again, 1.7 kV, they found exactly the same.
They find 1 kV, I think.
Maybe they have different assumptions for whatever. So then what's new here is that you're using new data on dark spheroidals or what?
Well, so like our approach is new. So in the Boyarsky paper, they only use the maximal coarse graining. Okay. And like they didn't do this solving of second genes equation and all that stuff.
Okay.
And also what they did, so like I remember that they used a certain dwarf galaxy that has a very, very high phase space density. And actually that's one we didn't use in this particular paper. And I think the reason why I didn't do it was more like because our collaborator Justin Reed didn't apply all his machinery on a wide enough range of dwarf galaxies.
But it seems the bound didn't change much. Were you expecting that the bound was not going to change after you did all this work?
So we have a discussion also in the paper at the end where we make a comparison with Boyarsky's paper. I think I would say like that's our approach is a bit more robust, just because like we have this improved machinery and also like newer data actually that that's included in the graphs for your code. But yeah, like beyond that, and like what Grotsky has, I think like a vertical line that goes at to 1 keV, and they didn't include what the uncertainties are in their paper.
I see.
It's an improved approach, I would call it this way. It's not the end of the story, but I think it's like it's a logical next step. Because when we were doing this project, actually, they were simultaneously working on it too. And that's when we agreed to combine forces and just do it together. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So to summarize this part, the improved genes analysis allows us to probe the dark matter density profile and draw galaxies at small radii. And this is where the phase-based density is higher and allows us to get stronger limits. And like this method gives us robust lower bounds on the mass of fermionic dark matter. That's very complementary to those of other probes. So this will close the astrophysics part of the talk. Are there any questions so far about this?
So this bound, is it robust against the number of star neutrinos I have? Like I could imagine like a series of these states at a similar mass. So does it get weakened?
I mean, if it's degenerate? Not degenerate, but like if you have like,
close in mass, yeah.
But like, are they the same particles or?
Three steroneutrinos of 1.7 keV mass with similar mixing angles. Should your bound apply individually to all of them? Probably not, right?
No, because you really assume that like if you're one particle that counts for the entirety of the dark matter. And actually like this approach, like this, like things get very complicated once you start to think about like, as you said, like mixed dark matter, where for example, if you assume that star, like only a certain fraction of your dark matter is fermionic, because you simply don't really know how your object is formed, right? In that case, yeah. Like here, for example, we assume that like all of this like these star neutrino dark matter, for example.
Can I ask you yet another thing that very, very quickly? So Lyman alpha has a problem that bounds cannot improve arbitrarily on time because it has a natural cutoff, which is just the thermal or genes mass of the baryonic gas itself. Yes. So it's not that you can resolve smaller and smaller and smaller scales because anyways, there's a natural cutoff.
Indeed.
Do you have the same problem in this kind of arguments with phase-based distribution, or can you improve on these bounds with future data?
Actually, you can improve upon these bounds. And one of the way that we'll discuss is that you can, for example, rather than using Liouville's theorem, which is also an assumption you make that like that the distribution function doesn't increase, for example, you can run full-scale simulations and track the distribution function of your particle species. And
but in the end, compare with data, and data you will get, I guess, from just like tracing stars or something like that. And then, I mean, in the end, you need to compare with data in order
indeed. To about. But like the idea, like the phase-based density, they can improve in two ways. One is I observe a higher coarse grain phase-based density, right? That's where you can improve. Like that's where, for example, if you find like some dwarf that has even like a higher phase-based density, then you can apply this machinery directly to it. On the other hand, instead, like for example, like we are using here f max, the maximum of the distribution function. If, for example, you would run simulations and you find that the phase space, that the distribution function decreases, and there are indications that that the distribution function can decrease, like in the formation of your halo, and it means that like you will have a smaller fine-grained phase space density, and then you can really improve your bounds from both sides. Like that's one of the ways you can do it. But of course, like actually, like the group of Carlos Frank has done a simulation on this a few years ago, and they found that the phase space distribution decreases.
I don't understand. You cannot set bounds using simulations. You need to set bounds using data, right?
Yes, but I mean, like, the way you set bounds is by comparing data with your model predictions, right?
Yes.
And either you improve your data, like get a larger coarse grained phase space density, or your modeling improves.
Right. And but data also has this natural cutoff, no? Because I guess it also has this natural
No. I think it could be. So here we're talking about the profile of a halo, right? And this halo is already formed. In the other case, this cutoff you're talking about is really a cutoff in the number of halos. You see?
I see.
So like you think about the cutoff in the halo mass function. While here we assume that like such an object already exists.
Okay, I guess. Okay, never mind. I can just ask you later. Okay, thank you.
But just to follow up, on the same question, do you expect that Gaia observations will help also? Because you'll get like proper motions as well as radial velocity.
Absolutely, because actually proper motions are some of the additional input that Justin Reed put in his code. Yeah.
Okay, so do you have a sense for how much they can do?
No. Okay. Actually, like with this project, we let all the photometry, stereokinematic stuff, we left it for to Justin to take care of. Yeah. But I can imagine that, like, for example, if you have like the faint, like, there was, I think, very recently a discovery of ultra faint dwarf galaxies, and those that are like even more dark matter dominated. And I can imagine that maybe there it can help in some way. Right. So I will continue with the second part, in which I will talk about bounds on the lifetime of star neutrinos from BBN. And this is based on a number of projects I did with these people here. So before, when we considered KV scale star neutrinos, there are only two decay channels. One is a decay into three neutrinos, which is a dominant decay channel, and one is a loop suppressed decay into a neutrino and a photon. Now, even though this one is loop suppressed by the fine structure constant over here, this is the one that drives constraints, simply because you create a photon here. Okay. And like, where is it? And you see that like the constraints are pretty strong, right? So like your star neutrino has to live in this region of parameter space here. And in this region of parameter space, the scattering and annihilation of star neutrinos with standard model particles is very, it's like not efficient at all. So the way these particles are created are actually through oscillations with the active neutrino sector. Now, when you go to larger and larger masses, the mass splitting becomes larger, so oscillations become less efficient. And then another point is that the decay width grows as mass to the power of 5. So once you go to the MeV scale, you're for fixed mixing angle, like your mass becomes much, much smaller. So while the KV scale here, we are dealing with a potential dark matter candidate, at the MUV scale, you're like dealing already with lifetimes of order seconds, okay? And this means then that the X-ray constraint here is also not applicable anymore. And this means that like it opens up a huge region of parameter space that can go all the way up to mixing angle equal to 1, actually. So at the MEV GV scale, we then have the scattering of star neutrinos with star model particles, the annihilation, and the decay into leptons, the neutrinos, and charged leptons, and decays into mesons if they are heavy enough. So I will show a simple timeline with the relevant events that happened in the early universe. So let me just say is that because like these channels become relevant, because you have large mixing angles, it means that they can be thermally produced in the early universe, and their abundance can be large enough to also affect BBM. So a simple timeline. The first relevant event here is the decoupling of neutrinos, of active neutrinos at the temperature around 1.9 MeV. A bit later, we have then the decoupling of neutrons with proton. And then we have the annihilation of the electrons positron, and much later on, the start of nuclear synthesis. Now, for example, what we measure, what we observe are primordial helium and deuterium abundances. And what's really important here are the abundances of neutrons and protons. So for example, for the primordial helium abundance, what we care about is the neutron-proton ratio at the point of decoupling, which is determined by these reactions here, and the time that has passed between decoupling and start BBN, and that's because neutrons can decay. So within the standard model, the first reaction here, the one N mu to the right, it doesn't have a threshold, okay? That's because neutrons are heavier than protons. While the one, the bottom layer one of proton plus neutrinos to neutron plus positron, it does have a threshold. Like your neutrino needs a mass, needs an energy of at least 1.8 MeV for this reaction to happen. And this really sets the neutron proton ratio at the time of decoupling. And people have written some very advanced codes to do everything very accurately. And you see that the predicted values are in perfect agreement with the current measurements on N-effective and the primordial helium abundance. And there's also one actually for the deuterium abundances that I didn't include. Now, what happens if a star neutrino decays before neutrino decoupling? Now, the entire system is in equilibrium and reaction rates are high. So everything thermalizes quickly and you obtain back the standard model picture. But things get a bit complicated when your star neutrino decays around neutrino decoupling. Now, as I said before, there are like these three reactions that are relevant. What really happens here is that when a star neutrino decays into neutrinos around neutrino decoupling, the neutrinos don't have a high enough equilibration rate anymore to thermalize. So it could be that their distribution will be not thermal, it will have high momenta distortions. And then before in standard model, there was a barrier for this reaction to happen to the left. This barrier can be now overcome because of the spectral distortions at high energies. And this of course means that there's no difference anymore between the reaction here to the right and this one to the left. So the neutron to proton ratio becomes closer to 1. And it means that the helium abundance also increases. And that's where you can set constraints. That's when you can set constraints. Yeah. So what I did is I've written a code that tracks the distribution function of these active neutrinos in the presence of decaying star neutrinos. And for this, I use the unintegrated Boltzmann equation. So I track the distribution function on a momentum grid. And then you can compute the neutron-proton reaction rates, compute the nuclear reaction rates. Compute the nuclear reaction rates And then you obtain a picture like this one. So it is again for mixing with muon neutrinos, it's a function of the mass. And you see here that BBN really eats up a big chunk of the parameter space of star neutrinos. And you see this also highly complementary to direct detection experiments, even so much that the combination of BBN with Stern experiments excludes star neutrinos that purely mix with muon neutrinos at like 360 mu. So that's a cool result. And you see that like future experiments and proposed experiments really can like close this gap here. And I think it was you, Neil, who asked the question about the seesaw mechanism and the contribution to neutrino masses. So these particles can accommodate for that. And for example, now it means that you only have this white region of parameter space, at least within this mass range, that can do that for you. So I'll take a very short detour, because the interesting we found while doing the simulations was that an effective decrease even when the star neutrino injected most of its energy into the active neutrinos, which is a bit counterintuitive. You would think that like if I inject most of my energy into the neutrino sector, an effective increases. But we found the opposite. So why is that? So as before, if your star neutrino decays before neutrino decoupling, an effective remains the same. I said like it converges back to the sum model value. If it decays after neutrino decoupling, the injected energy remains in the neutrino sector. So an effective simply increases, but things get very complicated in the intermediate range when neutrinos are decoupling. So while the decoupling here is shown as like an instant process, in reality, of course, it's a gradual thing. And it's because a cross-section of the interactions of neutrinos that keep them in equilibrium is proportional to the energy squared, to the energy of the neutrino squared. So it means that the high energy tail of neutrinos stays longer in equilibrium. Now I'll try to explain this effect with a simple sketch. So before PIMP, or like before the decay of the star neutrino, the distributions of neutrinos and the electric positrons are the same because they are in equilibrium. And then after the decay, you have now a population of high energy neutrinos in the distribution function of neutrinos. And these high energy neutrinos are going to interact with the low energy particles. So they will interact with electrons, positrons. They will transfer energy to the electron positron sector. And the transferred energy will immediately thermalize because of the electromagnetic interactions. So basically what you do is that like the injected energy, part of it goes to the electrons, positrons, and it remains there, okay? So you'll get an increase of the distribution function of electrons, positrons. On the other hand, the low energy neutrinos themselves, they will not equilibrate anymore with the electrons, positrons because weak reactions are very, are not efficient anymore. So what you will end up here is really that the distribution function of your active neutrinos is smaller than the one of electrons, positrons. And we see this effect back when we apply this to star neutrinos. So when I plot here the lifetime function of mass, you will see here that like when an effective increases, when an effective decreases with respect to the standard model value. And xi nu here is the fraction of the star neutrino energy that gets directly injected into active neutrinos. So here in this region here, even though more than half of the energy is injected into neutrinos, an effective still decreases. And if you see the same thing happening here. And like this picture, of course, applies to any feebly interacting particle that you have in your universe. It's a general concept. And this has, of course, important consequences for CMB determinations, because Well, yes, CMB is also able to measure the primordial helium abundance. The error bars are about a factor 6 or 7 larger than the ones you would obtain by measuring measuring gas clouds to obtain like the current BBN, current measurements on the primordial helium deuterium abundances. So the constraint on CMB is really driven by the change in N effective. And we see that the CMB can only improve upon the BBN bounds at low masses, where N effective can significantly increase. Yeah. So this is the last part on the talk. And of course, the star neutrinos that are not constrained here, they of course change the properties of neutrinos, right? They also change N effective. They change their number densities, and this has interesting consequences because maybe surprisingly, with current CMB data, we are actually not able to measure the sum of neutrino masses. And why is that? I will here show an example. So I have here 5 drastically different distributions, okay? And these distributions, they all give the same N effective, but a different number density. And then I will run a standard CMB analysis with a Planck likelihood while varying the mass. And what I find is that I obtain back the same non-relativistic energy density of neutrinos. So what I measure is not number densities, I do not measure mass, but what I measure is the combination of mass times number density with current CMB data at least. And it means that because star neutrinos change the number density of the active neutrinos, it means that they also can change the mass constraint. So the cosmological mass bound can be relaxed for star neutrinos. And it means that this could also have interesting detection prospects at some neutrino facilities such as Catron Ptolemy. So here, it's a quick example. So here I showed the local number density on Earth of neutrinos as a function of the lightest neutrino mass. And this gray region is the sensitivity of the Ptolemy, the proposed Ptolemy experiment, which tries to detect the cosmic neutrino backgrounds. And this is the sensitivity of Catron, which tries to measure the neutrino mass. And the star here is the prediction within the standard model. So within the standard model, neither Ptolemy nor Catron should be able to detect the cosmic neutrino background or the absolute sum of neutrino masses. But now, like if you have particles such as star neutrinos in your system, if they decrease the number density of your active neutrinos, it means that the cosmological mass bound can be relaxed. So this star could move somewhere to the right. So it means that like if you have, for example, within the next 5 years, if Catron makes a beep, then star neutrinos could be a reason why they make a beep. And then they can be also like, then it can also be probed by the Ptolemy experiment. So yeah, to summarize this part, BBN and CMB, they give us lower bounds on lifetime star neutrinos, and they are highly complementary to the detection experiments. We found an interesting effect that star neutrinos or FIMS in general can decrease N effective even if they inject most of their energy into active neutrinos. And finally, because star neutrinos or FIMS in general can decrease the number density of your active neutrinos in the early universe, this can then relax your cosmological mass bounds, and this could have interesting prospects at facilities such as Catron or Ptolemy in the near future. That will do it for my sake. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks, Nashwan. Some virtual applause here. If there are any questions.
Yeah, are there any questions?
I mean, while people have time to think, I had a quick question. So when you talk about this new prospects for Catherine and Ptolemy.
Yes.
What kind of model do you have in mind for this? Like, not all stereoneutrinos will give you
indeed
a relaxation of the bound, right?
So, like, for example, the stereoneutrinos that live here in this unconstrained region of primary space, especially ones near the border, they can significantly decrease the number density of your active neutrinos. By how much? This is still a work in progress, by the way. So, like, we're still quantifying by how much, how to stream everything. But, like, it does happen, is my point in this model.
This lifetime, I mean, does it depend on what this thing is decaying into? It must, right?
Which lifetime?
So when you say that there is a function of the lifetime here, it should also depend on what the particle is decaying into, right?
Well, I mean, in this model, like, all the relevant decay channels and so on are already taken into account, right? So like, for example, I think I get you. So, like, in this case, we have a star neutrino that mixes with tau neutrinos only. And like, it takes into account all the relevant decay channels,
information,
and so on. Yeah. So this picture is not for a general thing. It's like specific for the ones that we've considered here.
I see. So there's only decays mediated through the weak bosons.
Yes. Yes. But you see, like this idea is not only limited to star neutrinos. You can really have any mechanism that relaxes the mass bound, the cosmological mass bound on your neutrinos. And then this could have interesting consequences at these neutrino facilities. It's a difficult, it's a very difficult thing to measure the neutrinos. like within the standard model, like, you say, okay, neither Ptolemy nor the Catherine experiments would be able to measure your relic neutrinos. So, like, at least, like, this could bring everything together, right? Like, if Catherine makes a beep, and if it's then, like, if Ptolemy can find something, then, like, it could be, for example, due to star neutrinos. The star neutrinos could give you neutrino masses, random symmetry. So, like, it brings everything together consistently, is my point. Without, yeah. Like...
Maybe we can talk a bit later. I'm wondering if other people have questions.
Yes.
Okay.
Can you explain once again what the yellow star means?
Yes. So the yellow star assumes a Fermi-Dirac distribution of neutrinos with this temperature.
Yeah, but it's a dependence anyway over the mass of the lighter state, yeah? Why choose the yellow star on this plot?
Oh, because, I mean, we just want to show, like, within the standard model, where do we sit in this region of primary space, really? And, like, to make comparison, because I think, like the yellow star shows that within a standard model, neither Ptolemy nor Catherine should be able to detect anything. And the yellow star, like, takes into account the bound from Planck on the sum of neutrino masses. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I see. You mentioned also, I have another, maybe, I know, note, question. You mentioned that the effective degree of freedom reduced in special region, yeah? But how it relaxes the bound of the mass?
Which degree of freedom?
You mean that it decreases the degrees of freedom and effective in some region, yeah? And also you say that it relaxes the mass constraint on the neutrino. Can you explain how it help you to relax the constraints on the mass of the neutrino?
I mean, like, the idea is here really that what you measure, I mean, because neutrinos are decoupled at very high temperatures, at at very high temperatures that are not relevant for the CMB. So any impact of neutrinos on the CMB is purely gravitational. It happens through their energy density, really. So what you really measure with Planck, it's not a mass or the number density, you measure energy density. So you measure the non-relativistic energy density, which is mass times number density, and you measure N effective, which is the relativistic energy density. And like as long as you keep like this mass times number density the same, like how you distribute the two contributions, like you could have a very small number density but a very high mass, like it still fits, like it still fits the Planck data. That's my point. And but the idea here is also like to come up with a motivated model in which that can happen, right? And like star neutrinos are, I think, an example of that.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any more questions or comments?
Well, if not, then let me return a bit to my question. I was just kind of curious, like, if I'm not decaying back to standard model neutrinos, for example, I guess I cannot make the claim that I relax the neutrino mass bound. Is that correct?
Or could you repeat that again?
If my standard neutrino, for example, decayed into less neutrinos than in the minimal model. So let's say you have the case mediated via the Z boson of steroneutrino to three light neutrinos. And you're saying that that's dominant in this case, right? The reason why I'm assuming that you're using the tau mixing for this is that you're decaying back to standard model neutrinos most often, right?
No. Actually, like the reason why we consider tau neutrinos here is because the bounds from terrestrial experiments are pretty much non-existent in this case. Like, for example, with the muon neutrinos, with the muon mixing here, we have like a lot of experiments that broke the parameter space here. But with tau mixing, I think you only have like charm and some other experiment that I can't remember. But like the constraints are all like above 10 to the minus 4, my point. Mm-hmm. So like you look at where is it here? It means like if you would make this plot for electron mixing and tau mixing star neutrinos, this entire region here of parameter space where an effective can increase is actually excluded. And in this like paper, we considered tau neutrinos just because we were interested in having both scenarios, like increase and decrease of an effect.
See. So for your final plot, this can happen.
Sorry, but like this effect can happen actually for like these high masses are still not excluded in all three mixing cases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But for your final plot, then what are the parameters that you're picking?
What are the parameters that I went?
That you picked. So the plot with the star. So if I want to...
This one?
That one, yeah.
Yeah. So
are you picking any specific parameters here or...
I mean, like here, I didn't include anything that is related to star neutrinos because it's still a work in progress. I just wanted to show like what's the current status when it comes to the detection prospect of Ptolemy attachment.
Okay, I see.
And like I just want to highlight here that cosmology really is a limiting factor. Not limiting factor, but like a strong factor here, right? Because like if the Planck bound, like if you would do like if you didn't have Planck, if you had W map or whatever, the star would probably be like at higher mass, would be like maybe in the Ptolemy region. But just because the Planck data is so good, it tells us like within a standard model at least, because you need to apply Planck in a certain model, the mass bound really currently lies here within a standard model. And we say like, hey, but if you add star neutrinos, you can decrease the number density. And then you can increase the mass bound because Planck only cares about the non-relativistic energy density. And it means that you can move the star to the right, not along this line necessarily, by the way, but it can move to the right by how much. Still a work in progress.
I see. So you still, yeah, okay.
Yeah. It could very well be, by the way, that like you start neutrinos, they decay into high-energy neutrinos, like they do decrease and like an effect on your number density, but you on the opposite side, you have created a population of high-energy neutrinos, right? Mm-hmm. And these high-energy neutrinos, for example, they are less likely to get clustered around Earth. Right. And in that case, for example, you can say, okay, so I have no clustering of my active neutrinos. So it means that the detection prospects are worse, actually. Mm-hmm. But that's all something that needs to be quantified, my point.
Mm-hmm. I see.